And this is part of what concerns me, is that our universities are places now where we could not have a protest and say things that are now being said in Tel Aviv by Israelis. The protests that are happening there this week, if they took place on Columbia's campus, our students would be expelled or are charged with very serious disciplinary violations. This is where we've come. It's impossible to talk about the kinds of things that, Amy, in your setup, of the horrible things that are happening right this week in Jenin, in Gaza. We can't talk about that at Columbia. So that's part of what concerns me, is that we don't know our history, and these new policies are keeping us from learning it.
And Natasha Leonard, we just have about 30 seconds, but you've noted that universities are not only facing attacks from Congress, they're also being subjected to lawsuits all around the country. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yes, we've seen a series of litigation, including at NYU, Columbia, Harvard, UCLA, bought by often unnamed students and faculty, often very frivolous suits that universities are forced to answer to nonetheless. And then through settlements and often non-public agreements, are then forced to change policy, often leading to the conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue this discussion over time. We'll link to your piece, Natasha Leonard. College administrators spent summer break dreaming up ways to squash Gaza protests. She's at the New School. Columbia Law Professor...
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO, in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this special membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, extreme heat sparking a state of emergency.
Check on those friends, family, and neighbors, especially those folks that may need a little bit more assistance.
Where cooling centers are open. Should the tax to pay for preschool for all wait a year? And in international news, a talk about the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 5th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. With temperatures forecast to reach 100 degrees during the day and barely dip into the 60s at night, Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson declared a state of emergency. It started this morning and lasts until Friday evening. The high heat will put everyone at risk, especially those living or working outside. Here are some key ways to keep your cool, courtesy of Chris Voss, Director of Emergency Management for Multnomah County.
At night, I keep those windows open. I like to keep a fan in that window that pull that cool air out from outside. And in the morning, I remove that fan, close those windows, make sure that cool air stays inside. Bring your pets in from outside, definitely during the hottest part of the day. Definitely don't leave your pets in cars, even if you're only going into a store for just a few minutes. try to stay in air conditioning for as much of the day as you can, certainly during the hottest part of the day. And if you don't have air conditioning, avoid those upper floors. Drink plenty of fluids. Also, try not to use that stove or stovetop, especially during the hottest part of the day. They'll heat your whole house up. And if we do lose power, try to keep that refrigerator door closed for as long as possible. That'll prevent your food from spoiling quickly. One thing we could do to make sure that we all stay safe is check on those friends, family, and neighbors, especially those folks that may need a little bit more assistance when we hit those really hot days. If you do need to be outside during the course of the day, try to slow down and avoid strenuous activity. Wear loose-fitting clothing, a hat, sunscreen, light colors if you got them. Consider going to the Multnomah County website, Help for When It's Hot. You can find a lot of great information, including our interactive map, to find places where you could stay cool. Also, sign up for public alerts at publicalerts.org so we can keep you informed. Consider calling 2-1-1 if you need to go to a location. They could also help you find a location, as well as one of the Multnomah County cooling shelters that we open during the hottest days.
By the way, those cooling shelters for the county will stay open between the hours of noon and 9 p.m. today and Friday. They're at Cook Plaza on Stark Street in Gresham and Portland Covenant Church, 4046 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. Multnomah County's plan to put a new preschool for all tax on hold for a year was up for discussion this afternoon. Here's part of that talk, starting with County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson.
We have a second opportunity to vote on this delay in the scheduled tax increase on preschool for all. I wanted to reiterate the importance of this program. We know that when kids start with a preschool education, they are far more likely to graduate from high school, attend college, and succeed in their careers. Preschool for All also makes a meaningful long-term investment in the future of our kids and our county by tackling a root cause of poverty and expands early childhood services, which are hard to find and unaffordable for many families. This program is making a difference in people's lives. It was developed through a process that included voices from across the community and informed by the lessons learned by other communities that have tried to expand preschool access. The care that we've taken in creating Preschool for All is one of the reasons it's so important to me that we steward it carefully now. Our careful work has paid off in the building of one of the strongest plans for universal preschool in the nation. We are focused on our commitments to the workforce and facilities for that our community needs, with high quality, culturally specific care, and our use of a mixed delivery model that provides families with choice and builds the pipeline of providers that can expand at scale. Today, we have an opportunity to make sure this program is responsive to the communities that need it most, while also providing a more thoughtful timeline for this program's next steps. I want to thank the Preschool for All team for joining us again this week, and I'm happy to turn things over to my senior policy advisor, Hayden Miller.
We are asking the board to change the date of the automatic 0.8% tax increase that is currently scheduled in county code to take effect on January 1st, 2026 to January 1st, 2027, so delaying it by 1 year. That will allow us to conduct a thorough technical advisory committee process where we will bring together demographers, economists, and other financial experts to delve into the details of Preschool for All's financial needs and propose recommendations on how to ensure that the program has the resources required to meet the commitments we've made to voters.
My name is Jay Clark. I'm part of the government affairs team at the Portland Metro Chamber to speak on behalf of their 2,300 members. Businesses, the majority of which are small businesses. On June 17th, EcoNorthwest produced an updated State of the Regional Economy report, which stated that the number one reason for the migration, the 25,000 some people that we've lost in the last 3 years in Multnomah County, is tax avoidance. The difference in income between those who have left and those that are moving in is staggering. It is something in the neighborhood of twofold, something like $80,000 in gap. We all know that those folks are moving to Clark County. For the majority, some are moving to Clackamas County, and some, unfortunately, are even moving out of the state. Adoption of this amendment would be a meaningful action to slow out migration and keep Portland competitive.
My name is Jim Ruler. I'm a physician who has practiced internal medicine for 51 years, a grandfather and a member of Physicians for Universal Preschool. Free, universal, high-quality preschool promotes population health and greater health equity. improves outcomes in education literacy and nutrition, raises high school graduation rates and college participation, leads to better jobs and higher incomes. Free, universal, high-quality preschool decreases adverse childhood experiences such as family violence or hunger, which cause toxic stress and are linked to chronic health problems like substance abuse and depression as adults. And free, universal, high-quality preschool promotes early detection and treatment of developmental delays, chronic health conditions such as asthma, learning disabilities, and sensory problems like vision or hearing impairment, improving learning and health. Columnist and Oregonian Nick Kristof has repeatedly emphasized that the number one strategy to reduce childhood poverty, a critical social determinant of poor health, is high-quality early childhood programs. And the Surgeon General's commentary last week highlights the epidemic of stress and related anxiety and depression facing parents, with adverse impacts on children caused by the challenges finding safe, affordable, quality childcare and early childhood education options. Other locales have embraced free, universal, high-quality preschool as a community investment in supporting the emotional and physical health of kids and families. Urge the board to preserve the vision for and full funding of Preschool for All to maximize the number of families participating and realize the full potential for our students.
Some of the comments today about the Preschool for All program at the Multnomah County Commission. Meantime, a new poll shows overwhelming support for protecting the greater sage grouse. The animal's habitat stretches across 10 states in the West, including Oregon. Eric Tegedov reports, this comes as the Bureau of Land Management is changing conservation plans for the species.
BLM is reviewing public comments on its draft environmental impact statement for amending and strengthening sage-grouse protections. The agency has plenty of public support for this. A poll commissioned by the Pew Charitable Trust found 93% of people surveyed backed the BLM's efforts to protect the bird and its habitat. Tyler Dungannon with Oregon Hunters Association says many support even greater protections.
In the western U.S., roughly 70% favored restricting some development of specific public lands to ensure long-term habitat protections for sage-grouse.
The poll also found that nearly 60% of respondents say sage-grouse conservation efforts boost economic development. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife data from 2019 says hunting, fishing, and wildlife viewing fueled $1.2 billion in spending in the state. Josh Collins is a retired landscape ecologist in Bend. He says there are positives to BLM's plan for conserving sage-grouse, including the expansion of areas of critical environmental concern for the bird and the agency elevating conservation as one of its priorities on public lands. But he says there's also room for improvement, such as a focus on ensuring sage-grouse chicks have wildflowers to feed on in their first few weeks of life.
One of the things missing in the BLM report and almost every other state or federal report concerning the sage-grouse is a focus on the dietary needs of the chicks and the brood hens.
Collins adds that bringing back the sage-grouse means bringing back wildflowers in the region, which will benefit other species.
Young pronghorn benefit from that. They eat wildflowers. And, of course, the pygmy rabbit does. Many birds are feeding on the insects that are attracted by the wildflowers. So the wildflower is a missing piece of the foundation of the ecological health for the whole system.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Climate change is leading to new challenges when it comes to growing coffee. As Suzanne Potter reports, even though Brazil and Vietnam are the current largest coffee-producing countries, production is increasing in places on the U.S. West Coast.
Climate change is forcing farmers to move to higher ground to escape rising temperatures. The most popular variety, Arabica, is being squeezed out in favor of a hardier plant, Robusta. But Blanca Castro with the International Women's Policy Alliance in Guatemala says small farmers often don't have the time and money it takes to adapt.
If the producers are not doing enough to have a decent livelihood, they either sell their land, change the crop, those kind of decisions that sometimes needs to be taken by small families where the struggles are every day.
The demand for coffee exceeds the supply. Heat and unpredictable weather patterns are leading to big problems with a fungus called coffee rust. Some farmers are moving toward shade-grown coffee, but Castro says national governments need to help their producers learn new ways to grow and market their crops. Hannah Nushwander works with World Coffee Research, a nonprofit funded by industry giants such as Starbucks that works to diversify the coffee supply. She says the organization helps countries provide farmers with modern breeding tools and newer varieties of coffee.
Many of them are growing older varieties that are very susceptible to climate change, which just makes it harder for them to sustain their livelihood. So one of the things that we think is most important going forward is to increase the number of choices that farmers have about what they're growing.
Costa Calavrusis with Osito Coffee says the industry's economics are skewed too far toward the big roasting giants at the expense of small farmers.
Mostly American and European corporations are making a killing and then leaving producers with just about nothing. I think the industry is worth over $200 billion now, and coffee-producing countries are retaining less than 10%.
One study found that increased production of coffee in forested areas encourages clear-cutting, reducing habitat for many species. Calavrusis encourages consumers to speak out against environmental degradation and economic injustice caused by the global coffee trade. I'm Suzanne Potter.
15 rivers are getting some new water quality protections. Eric Galatis has that story.
Nearly 1 year after the U.S. Supreme Court left key watersheds unprotected by the Clean Water Act, the Polis administration has designated new protections for some 385 miles across 15 rivers and streams in the upper and lower Colorado, Eagle, Yampa, and Roaring Fork river basins. Chad Rudo with the Roaring Fork Conservancy says the outstanding waters designation is an important tool for protecting drinking water.
Which means it's protecting the actual quality of the water. And that's the highest level of protection that can be given to a stream within the state of Colorado.
The designation aims to protect existing high-quality waterways from any future degradation, including pollution from development, mining, oil and gas extraction, and other uses. It does not affect any existing uses in the watershed, so long as they don't degrade current water quality. I'm Eric Galatis.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $30,000 by September 21st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest and then KBOO News in Depth with Laura Grimes from Oregon Arts Watch. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, a red flag warning in effect until 7, clear skies down to 63. Tomorrow's weather, near record high temperatures up to 97. Sunshine and excessive heat warning continues to kick in tomorrow at noon. Today in history, on this date in 1835, Sam Houston was elected president of Texas. Our quote of the day is from Houston. A leader is someone who helps improve the lives of other people or improves the system they live under. The Oregon Historical Society held a special forum featuring two historians and scholars talking about the ongoing conflicts in the Middle East, especially between Hamas and Israel. Dr. Chris Nichols, a former Oregon State University history professor who is now at The Ohio State University, led the discussion. I asked him about some of the protests, especially at universities in Oregon, including PSU and the University of Oregon.
Really, a broad audience who's interested in these questions related to Israel, Gaza, Palestine, the U.S. dimensions of the protests. We've had protests on campus. There's a lot of folks focusing on the violence that first happened on October 7th and then followed in Gaza October 8th and thereafter, question of ceasefire. So what we're really tackling, though, also is the historical context. What informs this? I think a lot of us, when we hear these information such as 40,000 Gazans killed or that this is an unprecedented terrorist attack by Hamas. How did we get there? Why is there not a two-state solution? In what ways is the U.S. a possible arbiter or peacemaker here? And in what ways is the U.S. ethically compromised, perhaps, by providing weapons to Israel? How did we get to this point, I think, is really essential in just understanding the news on one level, and in another way, in trying to chart a path forward. It seems like the atrocities in Gaza have risen to a level that has gotten the attention of more total people. There was a pro-Palestine movement on college campuses and an activist network that's been around for a long time, but they were really galvanized by what happened following the attack. I think many of them, at least certainly the activists that I know, were really repulsed by Hamas's attack in Israel. And then they were galvanized thereafter when Israel seemed to take this inordinately large leap into large-scale violence against civilians in Palestine. So it's the scale and scope of the atrocities and the suffering. And another aspect here, I think, is the way in which our contemporary society, and you and I have talked about this a lot, is so polarized that we almost find poles where there don't have to be them. Couldn't we just agree that the actions on all these sides here have been unethical? A ceasefire, humanitarian aid makes sense for everyone. But because of the ways in which our society in the U.S. certainly has been polarized, you hear anti-Semitism, Islamophobia being thrown around, lots of hate speech. It's amplifying and intensifying the feelings. And then that's led to some of the campus violence, some of the, in my view, needless crackdowns by university administrators. Instead of trying to protect all the students and just let them protest, we've seen a kind of first resort by a lot of university administrators to saying you've violated time and speech and rules and regulations or space laws on campus, and then sending in police forces. These university administrators, in my view, by cracking down, they then have created a place and a space where lots of folks want to gather to continue rallying around the cause. And some sort of extreme people are coming there to express hate speech, which then tars both sides in the sort of optics of the moment. So Salim is a fantastic scholar, Salim Yacoub, a professor at UC Santa Barbara, and he's written both kind of sweeping textbook style books about Middle Eastern history, U.S. Middle East relations, and more narrow studies that help to understand Arab American communities and protest movements and activists in the U.S.
And here's part of what the University of California, Santa Barbara's Dr. Salim Yacoub said during the program.
What I would like to see is more of a sense of how this could potentially be resolved via some kind of a settlement between Israel and the Palestinians that would result in the establishment of a Palestinian state in as much of the West Bank as can possibly be salvaged, that, of course, shrinks all the time, and the Gaza Strip. I think what often happens, and it's understandable because there's just so much really gripping and disturbing activity taking place in Gaza itself, is that there is a tendency to lose sight of how the West Bank fits into that picture. A lot of Netanyahu's strategy over the last couple decades, really, and in fact, it goes back before him to Ariel Sharon in the early 2000s, the so-called withdrawal from Gaza, which isn't really a full withdrawal because Israel continued to control that area in all sorts of ways, was very intimately connected to a strategy of holding on to the West Bank. The idea was that you lessen your involvement in a draining commitment in Gaza that enables you to free up resources and attention to hold on to the West Bank. And also just the way that it was done, pulling out of Gaza without, or pulling out the military ground forces and settlers without coordinating with the Palestinian Authority. It sent this message that Israel doesn't have a viable partner and can essentially act unilaterally in Gaza and the West Bank. And so I think it would be helpful if the analysis focused a bit more on the way these parts fit together and also how a resolution could possibly emerge. And I don't, kid myself that this can happen anytime soon, but it is something that I do think needs to be pushed for in coming years. And yeah, that it would essentially involve a full withdrawal or as close to a full withdrawal as possible from the West Bank so that a viable Palestinian state can be established there.
That discussion was part of the Oregon Historical Society's Historians and the News series, a fundraiser and educational event. Vice President Kamala Harris condemns gun violence after a deadly high school shooting in Georgia. The U.S. Attorney General addresses Russia's latest attempts at election interference. And former President Donald Trump finally admits he lost the 2020 election. With more on some of the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2024 Talks.
It's just outrageous that every day in our country, in the United States of America, parents have to send their children to school worried about whether or not their child will come home alive.
Vice President Kamala Harris went off script at a rally in New Hampshire Wednesday to condemn gun violence. A shooting at a high school in Winter, Georgia left two students and two teachers dead. Georgia Republican Congressman Mike Collins represents Winter. He's now facing criticism for a two-year-old video where he fires an assault rifle and pledges to support former President Donald Trump.
Georgians are sick and tired of weak-kneed, spineless politicians who won't fight for Trump, get to the bottom of 2020, and fix our election. Well, if they won't do it, Mike Collins will.
The White House is renewing calls for an assault weapons ban and universal background checks. Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says it's not normal for children to live in fear of school shootings. Meanwhile, the former president has, for the first time, admitted that he actually lost the last election. On a Russian-American computer scientist podcast, Trump described the vote totals as much closer than they actually were.
I was told if I got 63 million, which is what I got the first time, you would win. You can't not win. And I got millions of more votes than that and lost by a whisker.
Former Wyoming Congresswoman and outspoken Trump critic Liz Cheney says she's going to vote for Harris.
Because of the danger that Donald Trump poses, not only am I not voting for Donald Trump, but I will be voting for Kamala Harris.
A new ABC Ipsos poll shows a strong majority of Americans are prepared to accept the election results, regardless of who wins. That includes more than 9 out of 10 Harris supporters and more than 3/4 of those backing Trump. The Department of Justice is accusing two employees of the Russian state media company RT of funneling millions through a Tennessee company to push videos on social media platforms. At a Wednesday meeting of the Election Threats Task Force, Attorney General Merrick Garland gave more details on Russia's latest attempts to interfere with U.S. elections.
The Justice Department is seizing 32 internet domains that the Russian government and the Russian-sponsored actors have used to engage in a covert campaign to interfere and influence the outcome of our country's elections.
Garland says the Kremlin still wants Trump to win and hopes to weaken support for Ukraine. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is doubling down on his ceasefire negotiation demand that Israel keep control of the Philadelphia Corridor, a strip of land between Gaza and Egypt. Netanyahu is being blamed for failing to reach a deal in time to bring home 6 hostages before they were killed by Hamas. In contrast with his hardline stance, Netanyahu asked the families of the dead for forgiveness.
I don't stand in judgment of these tormented souls because they're undergoing an agony.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
The Arctic Basin's microplastics concentration is the highest on the planet. Reservation dogs try to beat the heat amid shelter shortages. And the largest doctors group in Canada says it will apologize for past and ongoing harms. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez in National Native News.
A recent report from the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, or ACAT, documents extensive community health risks from plastics in the Arctic region. The report incorporated scientific information from more than 250 peer-reviewed studies globally. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra has the story.
According to the report, concentrations of microplastics are higher in the Arctic basin than in any other ocean basin in the world. Bawanuk Vai Wakayi is the Environmental Health and Justice Director for ACAT. She says plastics and chemicals from all over the world deposit and accumulate in the Arctic oceans in what is called a hemispheric sink.
Because of our reliance on our subsistence foods and because of where we live, we are some of the most highly contaminated people on the planet. A burden we didn't create, so it's so important that we are proactive.
Microplastics are found around the globe, but studies show the Arctic contains some of the most highly contaminated animals and people in the world. Scientists still don't know exactly how microplastics affect people's health. But chemicals in plastics are known to cause cancer, to interfere with how bodies use hormones, and to harm brain and body development in children. Pamela Miller is a founder and executive director of ACAT. She says microplastics have been found in placenta, newborn stool, and breast milk.
Both microplastics and nanoplastic particles can cross the blood-brain barrier. So the short summary of this is that babies are entering this world with their brains and bodies contaminated with plastics.
ACAT is a nonprofit that advocates for legislation to protect Alaskans from toxic chemicals and plastics. They worked with State Representative Andy Josephson on a bill to restrict disposable styrofoam packaging in Alaska. Styrofoam food packaging is an environmental pollutant and one way microplastics contaminate people's bodies. The organization also advocates for a global plastics treaty to reduce production and use of plastics and to ban adding toxic chemicals to plastics during manufacture. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Dogs are feeling the heat. Shelters are at capacity, especially on reservations with underfunded infrastructure, and climate change is compounding the problem. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports.
When a wildfire burned through the San Carlos Apache Reservation earlier this summer, a rescue team drove around all night picking up dogs with burnt paws.
So they had to makeshift a shelter, which is really rough to do, especially when the world's on fire.
Taylor Dawn Stagner is the Indigenous Affairs reporter at GRIST, a climate-focused publication. She's been investigating the impact of rising temperatures and more extreme fires, and says reservation dogs, despite being known as resilient, are having a hard time finding water because of climate change.
It's going to make some of our most vulnerable people, but also animals. It's going to make it worse for everyone.
Stagner says tribes are working to expand spay and neuter clinics to curb the dog populations. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
The Canadian Medical Association will publicly apologize for its role and the role of the medical profession for past and ongoing harms to First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people in Canada. A ceremony will be held on September 18th in Victoria, British Columbia. The CMA is inviting Indigenous leaders and community members to attend the apology. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 5th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote